Hello and welcome to Simplified, your weekly source of knowledge, enlightenment, and lot more bullshit like that. Let's begin as we often do, not always, with a round of introductions. And this time, the introduction must be accompanied with your most embarrassing childhood memory.
Oh, all no. Right.
So yes. So mine would be okay. Let me start with. I'm Sriket, of course. And
wait,
my
are you going to tell us the whole Sriket story?
No, there is not going to be any story that is going to be mentioned over here. It's going to be a fairly concise one of so, when I was. This is one of my earliest childhood memories. I think I was about 4 or something, and I was on a family trip in somewhere in Gujarat itself, and we had gone to like a slightly remote part of Gujarat somewhere, and I had severe diarrhea. So now in that particular instance, that entire trip, there was a road trip that was pretty marred both inside and outside our rented car by my severe episodes of diarrhea. So I remember very clearly about how it was fairly uninhabitable inside the car, and we had to make several pit stops, not just to accommodate for my expulsions, but also for everyone to get some oxygen. So,
wow.
So yeah, I mean, and the problem is this was exactly around the age where memory started coming, and I understood the concept of shame and inconvenience. And this was right. I wish it had happened a year earlier, but unfortunately, is where it was. So that would be my most embarrassing memory, I guess.
And that's how you started working in advertising.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the bullshit started way in advance. So who's next?
Who wants to go next? I'll go next then. My biggest challenge was actually narrowing down on one childhood memory. Also, what did you mean by childhood? I was not very clear. I think if you draw a graph of, you know, most embarrassing, like your memory, I would grant for a 4-year-old. It's fine. But if a 16-year-old had done that, that would be a little more embarrassing. So with this weighted average sort of thing, my most embarrassing memory, would be when I was around 12, I got stuck in an airplane loo and I had to bang it open till the air hostess let me out. I just couldn't figure out how to operate the damn thing from the inside. And to this day, I have a fear of airplane toilets. I think ever since that incident, I must have gone to the airplane loo like 4 times in total.
Excellent.
Yeah. More
that must be quite traumatic. I mean, if you can't figure out how to get out, that thing is very claustrophobic.
It is. And you literally have only one other exit option and you don't want to exercise it.
Are you talking about a golden parachute?
Oh my god, it's actually aquamarine in the case of airplane loose, but
the golden shower thing, right?
Too many references are being dropped over here.
Oh my god.
Okay.
That was Chuck, by the way, part but forgot the introduction part. But yeah, Tony, go ahead.
Yeah, memory is clearly a problem right now.
So
Tony, yes, Tony.
Yeah, hi Tony. So I don't know if any Malus are listening, and if you've spent any time in Bangalore, there used to be this horrible journey from Bangalore to Kerala where everyone's had one of these diarrhea stories. So much so that it's not even embarrassing.
By the way, sorry to interrupt, but any journey that starts in Bangalore or ends in Bangalore is horrible. Please continue.
Yeah.
This is true. A different kind of sonic boom. So I mean, that's not even embarrassing anymore, actually. But like when I was really small, I used to hate writing, like really used to hate writing, like till third standard or something. Not third standard, maybe till first standard or something. My mom used to write all my cursive writing, these things and all of that. And that continued. So one day I got like a scrape on my finger and I'm like, yeah, I don't have to write in school also. So one teacher asked me, like, why are you not writing? I'm like, see, scrape finger, I can't write. But then, like, she caught me in the break playing cricket, holding the bat with that hand. And she made me demonstrate my bat holding technique without using the scraped finger. So, yeah, that's a lasting scar.
Oh, my God. Yeah, no, teachers were particularly cruel. Like, when around the time, the late 80s kids must have experienced some pretty, the last generation of really cruel teachers, I think we experienced. And I remember there was one teacher who decided, some vindictive agenda, decided to punish me by making me sit on the floor for a whole week. while the rest of the class sat on benches. So because there was some, I don't even remember why, but like just she said, oh, you're sitting in Pathshala. And she made me sit on the floor. And
I'm like, this was in Gujarat, no?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Gujarat model, explain.
Yeah. So that is particularly negative. Anyway, go for it, Naren.
Yeah. So
what happened in the 10th century that we don't know?
Yeah, I know.
back in the reign of the Cholas. this happened in Bangalore, right? So there was this tennis exhibition match happening between Vijay Amritraj and Anand Aprita. They were like superstars back then. And someone dragged me along. I had absolutely no clue what tennis was. And one of my aunts was a big fan of Vijay Amritraj. So she gave me an autograph token. She said, go get Vijay Amritraj's autograph. And I just went, and after the match, I saw a bunch of people going towards the player, so I ran along with them. And when I was watching the match, there were just these two guys, you know, very similar looking, white clothes, dark complexion, playing. So I went to the first guy I saw, and I gave him my autograph book. And then I realized that everyone was actually going to the other guy. So the guy I had given the autograph book to was Anand Amritraj. So I yanked the book from his hand before he could sign it and ran to Vijay Amritraj. It was a very terrible thing to do. Yeah.
Somewhere in a parallel universe, this is Anand Amritraj's most embarrassing moment.
At this very moment, he's telling the world that's not no kid who did this to
him. No, the famous Narendra Shenoy.
Anyway, that's what happened during the Chola dynasty. But now, Naren, we want more, yeah?
My God. That is truly on that note, I think we should quickly move to the profundity, which we have also not done for a while now.
Inconsistent profundity. I think because our WhatsApp family groups have become more serious and they're sending daily updates.
Though this time my family group has delivered, I have found a COVID special profundity.
Lovely.
So there it goes thusly. We are, it's a picture of a lamp on a table. That's all. There's nothing more to it. It's like to picture home. All right. And the text is, we are not stuck at home. We are safe at home. When we change our thinking, everything changes. The world is closed for renovation, grand reopening soon.
Wow, okay. This is actually profound. So COVID has transformed us so much now that these forwards actually make sense. I'm like, that's actually profound.
This triggered something. That's what I was thinking. This actually triggered something like a thought for me, which I was thinking about. This whole world is closed for renovation, grand reopening soon. It almost, I was thinking about it like, what if this was like a Truman Show kind of scenario, right? Like, so each one of us is like, we can look at it from our perspective that like the world really needs a big upgrade. So they basically put you at home and call this a big pandemic, and they're actually renovating the world out there for you.
Nice.
So, on that.
I don't have so much faith in the BMC and all that they
Fair point. that's what I was saying, right? I was telling my wife the other day when we were walking outside here, I was like, for once in Bombay, I hope they dig all the potholes they want right now and fill them
I
up.
I know.
Like, yeah, you know what? All that
nobody's doing it, yeah.
It's like, dig everything you want. Dig the whole goddamn road up. Anyway. But on that, so yeah, on that, we shall transition from the reason we were talking about our childhood memories was because our topic of the day revolves around what causes childhood, which is childbirth. And the concept is...
So I thought you were going to go with... diarrhea is hereditary because it runs down your genes.
Well, diarrhea in Telugu is hereditary because of our food. So that is at least there, but I don't know about everyone else. But anyway, the topic of today is what we call antinatalism. So the grade of this article started when I read this podcasting host, Amit Verma of Seen and the Unseen fame. He wrote a really interesting article about antinatalism where he made like some very proper, very key arguments. So he said that it says that there are a couple of principles that you need to adhere to, right? Saying that... From a moral life point of view, there are three principles that we need to agree with. One, that we should not cause suffering to others. Two, we should not kill anyone. And three, consent is all important. And we should do nothing to others without their consent. These are three principles that are like self-evident and like the cornerstone of civilized society, right? But if these three principles, if you adhere to them, childbirth kind of like breaks all three of these principles, because when you bring a child into the world, the first principle is that you're anyone who's born undergoes suffering at some point or the other, or a lot of the time undergoes suffering. So you are causing suffering to others. Two, we should not kill anyone. The fundamental thing is that if you're bringing someone to life, they are going to die. So you are responsible for their death. And three, consent is all important. And that is also the cornerstone of the antinatalism argument, saying that anyone who is born without their consent, right? So you're violating all of these three core principles of civilized life. And therefore, he argues, how can this be ethical? And then he quotes and he writes, his friend, writer, podcaster, Naren Shinoy once said, if you really love your children, you won't have them. So, at that point, I will segue to Naren to elaborate on that argument.
I remember the conversation with Amit where this entire thing was born. antinatalism thing was born. Yeah. So, both of us feel very strongly about this, and I am often the object of derision at home. Because my wife thinks I'm the prize hypocrite. After having two kids, I go around telling people they shouldn't have any. So,
you're pro. Okay,
I'm pro antinatalism. That's a very corny way of putting it. But I'm pro anti. Okay. Yeah. So
you're natalism, basically.
Yeah, I am pro anti. I'm pro and anti cancel out. So natalism. I am a natalism, and my basic reason is what Shikhe just said. See, basically, what happens is at least by my experience, there are times when I wished I was never born. Right? Things look bleak, things look bad, and you don't have the option, right? Now, if you're born, you have to, there's only one way out, and it's not a pleasant way. So, you can't but help feeling sad that you have no option. Nobody has any option at all. And the only option was your parents. They could have chosen not to have you. And so... I extend that principle to generalize the point of view that no one should have any kids, because if the kids decide later that they wish they'd never been born, that's not possible. So then that would be on you, because you didn't take their consent to bring them to this world. And I am doing a terrible job of arguing my position, I know, because
it sounds like you're conflicted. You're acutely aware that you're being hypocritical.
Yeah. No, but I really do. I tell my children, and my older son seems to be convinced, and my younger son says he's going to have 4 kids. So screw you.
Compensating. Wow, okay.
Yeah. But at least you've raised such confident youngsters who know that they're going to find mates to procreate with. So you've not done a bad job at all, Naren. Thereby, you've cancelled out your entire argument.
I know. It was, I mean, I think what your children's age is, I think I was antinatalist by without like not by choice. So at that point I was like, who's going to go anywhere near this? Anyway, so that was actually this episode, so to speak, there are some facts that I will be talking about that's, but I want to kind of like make it more of a discussion or an argument where we state our stances. And what I was thinking was there is, of course, it starts with fundamental natalist ideology, right? Like, I mean, everyone thinks that it's obvious that everyone needs to have children and there's a biological urge. But the natalist ideology, I mean, if you were to go really far back, is simply that people had more kids because they wanted more allies, effectively, right? And more help. Yeah. You wanted more hands to help you out on the farm. You needed more people to help you for hunter-gathering and all that stuff. So, hunting and gathering.
To support you during old age.
Yeah, so and that. So, those were the fundamental reasons why you did it. The second thing was also, and that converted to religious ideology. And once religion came into play, it became doctrine that if you're not having children, it's morally wrong. And it's religious, it's offending God, it's offending all of the so-called people in the sky. And when you do this, and then religion started enforcing that, oh, you're supposed to have children, you're supposed to have X number of children, have children in a certain way. Marriage became an institution that it was created to encourage the childbirth model, and therefore the family unit came into play. So the entire natalist ideology is initially set on the world that was back there at one point in time. But therefore now, what happens is the whole antinatalist ideology comes as a reaction to the way life has changed now. Mm. Like, there is no moral, economic or practical imperative to have children anymore. And a whole bunch of people are like kind of waking up to that and coming up against it. And the primary arguments that you have right now are, of course, see, the very first thing being the practical aspect of it, which is first is cost, right? By an estimate on an Economic Times article, now this is US-based data, but we can extrapolate to India. The cost of raising a child from birth to the age of to maturity, which is up to 21 years of age, for a middle to upper middle income family comes to about 55 lakh rupees overall. The average cost.
Dear God, how many headphones you can buy with that?
So,
go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, no, I just want to take a pause here because I think we've sort of digressed from the original moral position to a utilitarian.
We just totally
jump in, jump in, jump in.
We should cover the moral aspect first before moving on, perhaps. And as the only, like, parent who is not taking an absolute position on this podcast, I think I need to sort of interject. And so I remember this was a while back, quite a few years ago, when Naren actually mentioned this. And I think I just had a baby at that point in time. And I took a firm stance against it. I think Naren also remembers that. But so just to, you know, in the interest of people listening to this podcast who might be taken aback by something as radical as this, I think it's important to look at it from a philosophical point of view and say, evaluate this philosophy for what it's worth. And, you know, if it makes sense, take it. Otherwise, leave it. So none of these need to be like, you know, absolute ways of living, right? For instance, one of the greatest things that happened to me on this podcast was when Naren actually introduced me to Stoicism, which was like completely new to me. But in effect, as a parent now, Stoicism is helping me cope with the whole parenting aspect. So it's a good idea to be open to you know, new philosophies, but also to evaluate for what they're worth, right? And on the principles of, you know, consent, happiness, etc., I think it's a little too far-fetched, right? One is to say that if you've spent any time over 30 years, you know for a fact that you will bring suffering to people, right?
There are several
people's stories in which you are the bad guy. And also the realization that there is nothing you can do about it, right? So suffering, of course, is a part of innate part of life itself. But that doesn't mean that you kill yourself now, right? So if you take an absolute position now to say
that's great argument.
If you take an absolute position now to say that since I bring suffering to a lot of people, why should I, you know, go on making more suffering? The way to end that is to kill myself. That is, you know, stretched to the limit. That's one counter. Of course, like it's probably like stretched too much, but the point holds. The other thing is that consent in a society is absolute consent in a society doesn't exist, right? So for instance, do I want to pay tax? No, but I'll still do it, right? Or does the government consult me in terms of where my tax money is being spent? If I say, you know, it needs to go towards research on this, then creating a statue, will the government listen to me? No. Also, from any moral standpoint, you would say that children growing up need to go to school, right?
Yeah.
If you ask a child, should they go to school, they'll probably say no. So it's about understanding that, you know, absolute consent doesn't exist. Therefore, what are the degrees to which we make sure that society exists in a manner that is thriving? Which brings me to point one, which is to say that, is it really about bringing suffering or happiness? Because if you evaluate the curve of human history, COVID notwithstanding, we are at a point in time where humanity is at its happiest or at its most progressive in terms of...
Yes. That is without doubt. Yes.
Therefore, you know, based on all of these, I am not sure if one can say that, you know, you should bring a child into the world or not. But from a utilitarian point of view, which you sort of started getting into, I actually as a parent think, you know, to people who have not had a children yet, maybe you shouldn't. But that's a completely different argument.
Chuck, do you have a bone in this fight?
So, okay, first, my stance and my perspective, right? So, I'm very clear on the fact that the gene pool, the Gopalakrishnan gene pool is not going to extend forward from where I am anyway. But I think that's a personal choice, and I don't think a personal choice like this should be mandated onto society. I don't hate Tony more or less because he has a different point of view on this from me. From my perspective, there are certain reasons why I don't want a kid, and those could... And I honestly think my reasons are more personal than, a libertarian anti-natalism movement as such. For me, honestly, it's less about the, you know, the strain on the world and all that, more than the fact that I just think that I would be a terrible parent and I really don't want kids beyond two cats at home. So my reasons, honestly, are more selfish than, philosophical in that sense. I don't have an argument on this beyond that, and I don't think anyone should be begrudged having kids of their own, really. If somebody wants to have 2, 3, 4, 5, sure, go for it. I mean, as long as you're aware of the risks, or as long as you know what you're doing. I don't think it can be a universal policy philosophy, and I don't think, and here's basically what this rambling argument is leading towards. I don't think anyone is in a moral position to say you should have or you shouldn't have, be that parents, be that friends, be that religion, be that institutes, be that newspapers, or even be that podcast hosts.
Right. And, no, but that's where the argument gets quite interesting. So I have another friend who holds exactly that position that you talked about, which you don't hold, Chuck, which is that I choose that I'm not going to have children, but for everyone who does, I don't begrudge them at all. This person actually does begrudge people who do have children. Mm-hmm. And
anticipating what you're saying. Is this argument like your actions affect me? Is that kind of where he's going?
Yeah, so it's, I mean, there is this, there is this graph, and that's the second, so I mean, of course, the cost implication is a personal one where I'm ending up spending a whole bunch of money and whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other one being there is this environmental argument, right? So there's this chart that does the rounds all the time, which is very simply, it goes about saying that, it says that, see, there's a list of all the things that you do, you could do to live a more green life, a more environmentally friendly life. Like if you live car free, you avoid one round trip transatlantic flight, buy green energy, buy a more efficient car, switch to electric cars, eat a plant-based diet. All of these things. So in fact, that's what your tons of CO2 equivalent. If you were to accumulate all of them, if you were to do all of these things, you would save about roughly around 9.4 tons of CO2 every year. You would do that year. But were you to have one fewer child, you would save 58.6 tons of CO2 fewer per year.
That's a faulty argument. I have my two bits to.
Yeah, so before Naren gets to it, I'll just my counter argument to that is sure that theoretically on an Excel file and a graph, it makes absolute sense. Yes, everyone should, to flatten that curve, yes, everybody should have less kids and all that. The point simply is, if everyone on the planet stops having kids right now, you and I are going to be f***ed when we are older. We need people to continue working. We need people to carry. Like, who we? No, I mean, I don't say this like out of humor or anything like that. We need people to keep the economy growing while we are not, you know, actively contributing to. Unless we are reaching an argument where humanity should die altogether, then I buy that absolutist argument.
The other defect in that argument is as follows. What your friend is saying is somebody has to do something in order that his life be better. That is not a fair expectation, right? I don't owe him anything. I can have 10 kids, and by having 10 kids, if his life is going to be screwed, so bad, right? So that's not my concern at all.
I think just to like put it in context, you can't argue both sides of consent, right? You can't say that
exactly. That's a great argument. Yeah,
beautiful.
But the other part being that I think it there is that consent argument, and those are perfectly valid. I'm just playing the devil's advocate over here. The argument that comes out is that where. His opposition seemed more like from the perspective of effectively greenwashing, right? Like, think of it this way. You see the image of someone who is who's taken a huge bunch of plastic who's burning a plastic tire in their backyard, all right? Or a rubber tire in their backyard, right? Now, you look at that person with, like, disgust and all that stuff, and you look at them as, like, what the f*** kind of person is this? What a polluter you are, and all, whatever like that. Yeah. Versus the image of a person carrying a child.
Sure. Right?
And his argument comes from the angle that there are two people, there are two images of people next to each other. Which one is a polluter? Right. And the argument is the person who is carrying a child is a bigger polluter than the person burning a rubber tire.
This sounds like when PETA gave its pitch to, or brief to an ad agency, and they came up with the absolute worst for an organization called People for Ethical Treatment of Animals. Yes. Do you promote ethical treatment of animals, or do you say everyone who eats meat is a killer, right? Which angle do you go down? And that changed the course of history forever. So, yeah. I mean, in some senses, it's like that, right? Like, of course, there are arguments to go vegan, but, you know, I like eating my meat, so should I stop? So, I don't know if that parallel makes sense, but in some senses, it's like that. So, individual choice at the end of the day, if we are stemming from a libertarian argument, I would assume that individual choice wins outright.
Yeah, so let me try to bridge that argument just a little bit. I don't think I buy that the meat argument entirely. But see, I think the dilemma that your friend was in, Shriket, was if I can put it this way. Scott Galloway on his podcast has this nice concept of whether a company is a net positive or a net negative for society. And he's very clear on the fact that he thinks that Facebook has been a net negative on society. That is, leave Facebook out. And
Wait, I am eagerly waiting for his review of Simplified.
fantastic.
Okay, so like that, no, like if we had a hypothetical concept of net, I think it's somewhat similar to your
this burning fuel argument, burning tire argument, which is is a person
suppose it is possible to come out, you don't know whether a person is going to be a net negative or a net positive on society, right? Like, if you deny somebody who's going to be, who's going to contribute a lot to society, then the anti-natalism or the whole, you know, is going to pollute the earth more argument kind of falls flat. So unless in an ideal world, just imagine a situation where you actually have where you're actually able to figure out if these two procreate, then this person is going to have X amount of impact on the planet and then, proceed accordingly. But let's hope that a dystopian world like that does not happen.
I mean, that's actually quite worse, right? Where there is an arbitrary figure attributing value to someone's life or... Yeah. You know, the whole idea that there is a certain ideal type of person who's net positive or net negative in itself is something that cannot apply to humans to begin with.
This is like a combination of eugenics and the Big Four firms.
It's almost like when before conception you have to, I can almost look at a movie script where someone has to apply for a procreation license and you have to get a score before you can go ahead.
So Srikit, can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
What is the anti-natalist position on adoption?
So that's where this is where it comes down to the alternatives for procreation. So if you were to look at the recourses, the top one is adoption, primarily because of the fact that those three arguments, and I think those three arguments that Amit had put down in his article are really important. All those three arguments are kind of like sidestepped when it comes to adoption, because all the choices that have to be made before procreation have already been made by someone else.
But then you're still going to deny that child their right to consent, right? By saying you have to go to school, for instance, or you have to...
Oh, yeah. The consent argument in Amit's article was more about the consent of being born. So that consent is sidestepped.
That's a different argument. No, you can't give a consent to small children for their own safety.
And that's a slippery slope argument as well. Where do you stop? Like, some parent wants to...
No, it's accepted. Like, you have an age when the child becomes an adult, and after that, I think 18 is a generally accepted age. Or 21, I don't remember. Yeah, 18.
So that's the top recourse that's there. The other, of course, options are adoption of non-human babies, which is something Chuck is an advocate of. which is that I will...
Non-human beings, pets. The way you put it, non-human beings.
Yeah, like yeah. Own cars, yeah, non-human
beings. Yeah. Just say so, pets, no, non-human babies, I think.
No, but the phrasing is also important because at the end of the day, the top reason why people have children is to satisfy a paternal or a maternal instinct, right? Mm-hmm. You want to take care of another child, and that's kind of like a biological urge within us. To satisfy that, of course, adoption is one recourse. But the other recourse being that you're being a father to a pet also allows you to an outlet for those urges and emotions. So therefore, right. That is another acceptable recourse. And I don't know if you guys have seen Some Good News by John Krasinski that he's posting out there.
Yeah.
One of the best pieces of news that he delivered in that was, I think there was a video of one of the shelters in somewhere in the US where all the shelter workers were applauding because for the first time ever, all of their shelter animals were adopted. Like the entire shelter was empty.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think one of the positive side effects of this pandemic is that this adoption of non-human babies is going through the roof.
This also means more people are possibly procreating as we speak. So,
and that's
I don't know. I'm not sure of that. Actually, I know you said it in jest, but I'm genuinely not sure whether that's going to be a thing.
Okay, so that's my next segment actually, because there is some hard data we can actually look at and then have a conversation around.
Hard.
So there are two points here. One being that, of course, there is exactly what Tony said, the angle of, oh, people are in lockdown, a lot of people are together. Of course, there'll be a lot more procreation. We will see a baby boom after 9 months or whatever. That's an anecdotal logic that's coming about.
Yeah.
There are a couple of points that are there. First being that once this lockdown ended, so China is the index case for all understanding how life will be after the lockdown, because life has started and it's been a month since whatever has happened. And what they've seen is there has been a spike in divorces, first thing.
Mm-hmm.
So spike in divorces, and there are two solid reasons for it. One being, of course, that, oh, lockdown, people are together all the time. People have gotten sick of each other and filed for divorce. But the second argument, which is actually also a very logical argument, is that it's just a backlog, right? People couldn't get divorces because of the lockdown. So now everyone's getting their divorce right now. So that is also the other flip side of the other argument. So that's one point. The second point being, there is a beautiful article out there on IFS, actually. This site called Institute for Family Studies, where they have done like a statistical analysis of whether the coronavirus will spike births. And they have like a very interesting logic to it. First, they say that there is this concept of collateral survivors. Whenever there is any big calamity that like affects a mass of population, the concept of collateral survivors are people who have either been affected by a tragedy but not been killed by it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. And what they say is that collateral survivors across all the previous tragedies, including from SARS to 9/11 to major pandemics, have seen a significant decrease in birth rate. Mm. So people don't procreate during the occurrence of a major event. And also what it does is it reduces, therefore, the number of babies being born 9 months after. And in fact, what their estimate is that depending on the volume of population that's infected and therefore having a large number of collateral survivors, their estimate is that if 30% of the world's population is infected, and the mortality is near the WHO's current estimate of 3.5%, mm-hmm. they are saying births 9 months from now could fall by half.
Oh,
yeah. Wow. So their
that's a big number.
Mm. Yeah, that's a big number. Saying that, and 30% of the population is not an unreal estimate, especially when you look at the infection rates in a country like the US.
Yeah.
So their prediction is that the collateral factors, the collateral survivors are traumatized by fear during a crisis, and also the economic uncertainty leads. So therefore, all the factors that we talked about previously, which is the actual emotional factors as well as the practical factors, all come into play together, and they actually predict that the birth rate will significantly drop based on how bad the infection is. So we might actually see here, almost like an involuntary antinatalist movement happening.
You know what I want to do is have some data around births sparked by sports celebrations.
Yeah.
Wow.
How, you know, since there is no sport, that whole element of spontaneous happiness and therefore procreation has been eliminated. So once sports comes back, I'm saying the birth rate will go up. Okay, this was from the last episode. Sorry.
So this is the most fascinating article that I read recently.
I have one small thing to add to this after you're done.
Yeah. So there is Andres Iniesta and Xavi, who are Barcelona FC Barcelona legends. They have a thing where they talk regularly every year. So in 2009, Barcelona beat Manchester United in the Champions League final, right? Mm. And this was their first Champions League win against Pep Guardiola, and it was a big deal for them. The birth rate in Barcelona rose by 16% from babies conceived that month.
Wow.
And what they did was, in fact, what these guys do is that they actually have like regular calls with all the children who are born from that birth spike. Because they are all children born because of them. So that is one of the most... it's cool, creepy, everything at the same time, I think.
What is the score? What is the real score from that match?
Oh my God.
Reminds me of one Woodhouse quote in Blanding's Castle. Woodhouse writes, so this situation is Lord Emsworth is looking through a telescope and he sees his son Freddie, younger son Freddie Threepwood, running across the field. And a cloud forms on his brow because he doesn't like Freddie Threepwood because Freddie keeps getting into trouble. And Woodhouse writes, unlike the male codfish, which upon suddenly finding itself to be the parent of 500,000 little codfish, cheerfully resolves to love them all, the British aristocracy is apt to look upon its younger son with a jaundiced eye.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God. No, but the other one being that, Chuck, what you had, you touched upon it earlier about this whole movement to end the human race, what antinatalists may have. And there actually is such a movement. It's actually called the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement.
Wow.
And they call for all people to abstain from reproduction to cause the gradual voluntary extinction of humankind. And their reason is, of course, environmental degradation. And so that's the top, that's the key movement for that. And their ideology actually comes from this whole, they were established actually fairly early. They were established in 1991. So it's been around for a long time.
There's a business opportunity for a branded Kool-Aid with them.
Branded Kool-Aid. Yeah, but then that's what... also, I feel there is a... there is a middle ground somewhere over here. Because again, see, the funny thing is here that, of course, in countries like India, there's always a massive overpopulation problem. The government's line is have fewer children.
So
that's the narrative
that goes. I wanted to add something about that. So
yeah, go ahead.
I have like two conversations. So it's like again anecdotal, no data or anything. Mm. So one of the guys who supplies us metal, you know, sheet metal, is a small supplier. So if you need odd sizes or something like that, we ask him. He has 6 children, I think. Yeah, so he has 6 children, and he comes around to office one day, and he wants to, so, you know, he's giving an invitation for his eldest daughter's wedding and things like that. So we all congratulated him, and he was, you know, sort of weeping on our shoulders of how tough it is, and he has 3 more daughters, and it costs so much, and so on and so forth. And so I was just asking him, why do you have so many children? I mean, you know, it's, you know how difficult it is, and you have so many children, you can't really give them what you'd really like to give them, the quality of life and things like that. So he told me that, you know, the reason he's like, sahab, you educated people always laugh at us, but you know something, we are not rich people like you, so on and so forth, all that. And he said that if we don't have children, who is going to look after us in our old age? So the reason we have many children is at least one of them will look after us. And my watchman here, okay, who is a mouse-like guy, I mean, you wouldn't believe him capable of fathering a kid, but he's got like 7 or 8 of his own. And he told me that when I sort of said this, a similar thing, he told me almost the same thing. He says, I'm having as many kids as possible because at least one of them will look after me in my old age. Wow. So, I don't know how this thing is going to pan out in the Indian situation and COVID. You know, I really don't know how the majority thinks. So,
go ahead.
So I think the majority thought there, I think, brings another angle, is the common sort of societal pressure, right? So which is something I think even before we espouse or denounce antinatalism, which definitely needs to be tackled, is around just the societal pressure to have children when you're married. Yeah. Right? Yeah. And one of the things that, you know, still fascinates me is that despite us being like in mid-30s, there are several people who still are afraid to tell their parents certain things, right? Like, instance, they drink or something like that. So I think for the first thing to fix would be the idea that, you know, after 18, children can, you know, are free to determine what they want to do and don't hold on to them. And maybe that is a more realistic place to start and explain consent from rather than absolute position.
Wasn't there that kid in in Bombay a few years ago who sued his parents for having given birth to him without his consent? And his parents said, and his mom even said, and his mom even said, well, we are high court lawyers, so that's pretty gutsy of him to do that.
Rafael Samuel, Mumbai-based businessman, he sued his parents. But he actually, I mean, he himself admitted it later in an article saying that the whole thing was to make a point. Like he got, like he wanted to do that as a stunt to make a point about antinatalism, because he was part of the antinatalism movement in India, and he wanted to make a point about that. This is how I'm going to draw attention to this issue.
I'm reminded of yet another Woodhouse quote, I think from the same story. So it was like this: in his dreamy and romantic youth, Lord Emsworth regretted that the Blandings, that the Emsworths, though an ancient clan, did not possess a family curse. Little that he did he know that he would one day become the father of it.
Beautiful. From a larger economic point of view, the whole thing about what if you were to see an economist's point of view of whether what stance they would take, natalism is definitely the way to go because of this concept called the demographic dividend. India is among the, so India, it's there's the there is a the IMF paper says that India is because of the India high birth rate of India, by 2026 India's average age would be 29, which would be the least among the global average. which allows them the largest working population in the world. And so therefore, that is one of the key reasons why they are forecasting India to be the one of the superpowers in the decade to come, because of the fact that India has this demographic dividend, whereas all the other Western countries have severely falling birth rates. Yeah. And especially places like in Europe. And another interesting fact was one of the key arguments for Germany to allow so many immigrants from Syria to come in, the refugees from Syria to come in, was to help their demographic dividend.
Yeah,
because they were suffering a massive growth birth rate slowdown, and the new immigrants coming in brings in a huge number of younger people into their population, which helps their working force.
Yeah, in general, human resource is the greatest resource in economics itself, and migrants are a net positive. But I don't know, the argument for big cities, etc., post-COVID, will they change, etc., is a thing that we need to do. Because so far, all of the action was focused on bringing people together to create more and more, dense cities like Bombay. But that's actually led to an impossible COVID problem right now.
There are a few facts here and there, but honestly, I felt this topic required more of a discussion and a debate. And I think we had a great one here. That's for this episode of.
I have one fact. When they kicked Gandhiji out of Durban, was it? Anti KwaZulu natalism.
Oh my god.
I have been holding this back since the time you said you wanted to do an episode.
Well done, Chuck. Yeah. That is truly the best way to conclude this episode.
Yeah. No one will want to have a child after listening to
there's a potential that they can make a joke.
I know.
Yeah.
I don't want to bring a child into the world where Chuck makes such jokes.
Or can have the potential to make such jokes.
I want to see, that's what reducing suffering means, right?
I like how all your minds bent there rather than, I could bring another Gandhi into this world. That's not where your fucking mind went.
We have all become truly pessimistic in this lockdown.
We are not Mahatma Nirbhar.
Oh god,
well,
this keeps getting better. Before we conclude, we have a small announcement to make. So Chuck, do you want to take it away?
I do. Okay. Yeah, actually. This is going to be my last Simplified episode for a while. I am going to take a small break. We have had cordial board discussion, and I will be back sometime in the future. I'm going to focus on a few other projects that I want to do right now. Don't really want to get into too much of that right now. I think Simplified is in good hands or mouths anyway. That is it about that. Awkward.
Wow. Miles Steven Wilson feels are coming. But
right? No, don't. When Steven Wilson left Occupantry disbanded, please do not... be like, I'm trying to think of another. This is more like, I want to say Bruce Dickinson leaving Iron Maiden, but I don't think I am that important.
Yeah.
Also, Bruce Dickinson was born on my birth, 7th August.
I will miss not getting these music references.
I hope this turns out to be that way when hell freezes over type of reference.
From my point of view, thanks to everybody who's been a part of my journey. It's been 5 years since Naren and I recorded with our phones switching off the fan. And now here we are, recording on our phone, switching off the fan.
Full circle.
Full circle. Thanks. I would have never imagined back then that we'd be doing this like 5 years later, and people would be writing into us with like references like what microwave repair in Micronesia. And having an having live episodes and things like that. But yeah, I'm pretty sure I'll be back at some point of time. I just need to take a bit of a break right now. So anyone who needs to get in touch with me, you know where to find me, socials, etc. over there. But yeah.
In the meanwhile, Tony Naren and I are happy to receive your hate mail. So please feel free to give
you're talking to me, right? I'd like
yeah, I know. Right? This is what is going to happen. Chuck is basically taking a break to bitch on us.
Will it be totally meta if I write in saying now the show will improve now that you've got rid of that guy? Like,
I mean, we need at least one of those mails. So
yeah. Chuck, you will be sorely missed, and your the lack of we I think we will start making the puns on your behalf. Tony is definitely well equipped.
I have no doubt that you'll do a better job than.
Or a worse job, which is
which I shudder to think how it will go. But either way, we Simplified will continue next week with the three of us coming back to take a stab at this. So thank you everyone for joining in. Naren, do you want to take it away?
Stay safe. Stay. Unproduced and stay simplified.
See you guys next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.